The most amazing thing, the creator of heaven and earth, the God who delivered them out of Egypt, declares that he's going to enter into a covenant with these people. It's not a contract. It's a kind of binding agreement between things which couldn't possibly have any relation to one another, save for this kind of device, something which binds together God and man in a promise forever.
Dr. Cass, as we left the Israelites in our last conversation, we left them newly delivered from the hand of Egypt. They now found themselves in the wilderness. And we should begin our conversation now about the second main pillar of people formation, the giving of the covenant and law and ordinances. We should perhaps begin by asking the question, why law is necessary for such a people, and attend perhaps to the character of the people that is about to be offered this law.
Right. So they have been delivered from Egypt, but they are now 600,000 strong, not counting the women and children, in the wilderness. And the condition is, one could say, anarchy, which is to say the absence of any kind of law. They are somehow under the guidance of Moses, but that's it. And if one thinks with the benefit of having read the stories in Genesis and of Exodus, where one sees the character of human life uninstructed, we see the problems that get in the way of civil peace and order, murder, adultery, rape, theft, enslavement. We see certain kinds of passions that disturb the possibility of a rich personal life, fear, despair, greed, pride, and envy. One wonders what can be done to help this people, this is to speak generally, to help human beings live a decent and peaceful communal life and reform the passions that weigh them down and give them aspirations that might lead them in the direction of a fulfilling life. But we also have evidence about this particular people under these circumstances. And as we said last time, getting the slaves out of Egypt was easy, but getting the slavishness, the Egyptian slavishness out of the ex-slaves will be the large and enduring task. And in the episodes that follow, we get a bit of a taste of what this is like. First, and I think as we said the last time, we get in three separate episodes, the story addresses the three fundamental needs of any people just starting out: the necessities of food and drink, the ability to defend yourself against invading or threatening outsiders, and the need for some kind of internal regulation of disputes and public order. So we have the story of the grumbling episodes, we have the story of the attack of Amalek, and we have the account of Jethro's visit in which he finds Moses sitting there from morning to night adjudicating disputes amongst the contentious ex-slaves. These stories show the need for some kind of regulation. On the one hand, when food is scarce or water is lacking, the Israelites yearn for a return to Egypt, where though they were slaves, they at least imagined that they had meat in their pots and they were well taken care of. And they say to Moses, what, were there not enough graves in the desert in Egypt that you had to lead us out here to die? And by the end, they're prepared to stone him because they're impatient and Moses is just fed up with them.
I'd like to pause there and linger on that recognition for a moment, because of course, we, the readers of this text, who have seen the book of Genesis, we know the most dramatic breadth of human alternatives for what the uninstructed proclivities of humankind can point towards.
Right.
The slaves themselves don't have those tales of Genesis in their head.
Correct.
They have the experience of Egypt in their head.
Right.
And it seems to me that the terror of liberty, being out in the wilderness without any kind of external structure to order them,
right,
we should linger with that terror for a moment.
Yeah, good.
And just appreciate how frightening it could be to suddenly leave behind the order, an order which was not pleasant, but yeah, in fact, horrible for them.
Right. No, that's wonderful. But it was order, and basic needs were provided for. And in fact, the opening sentence after the episode at the Sea of Reeds anticipated also a certain terror of aimlessness. God says that you shouldn't lead them the shortest way to the promised land because they might encounter an army and decide they really want to go back to Egypt where things were at least secure and they knew their place. That's absolutely right. And the other thing, this is a subtle point, but Egypt is the watery place. The desert is dry. Nothing grows there. They're out there looking at this barren place. Maybe there's a little room for grazing cattle, but there's nothing that can grow here. So facing grim necessity and the absence of any kind of sense of your place and nothing to provide for, that's terror.
One of the meanings, therefore, of your recognition that the moral movement of the Book of Exodus is to take the slavishness out of the slaves,
right,
is surely this, that even a slavish order is at this point preferable to the newly liberated slaves than the prospect of an orderless freedom.
I think that's right. In a way, Moses is doesn't really understand the difficulty that they have. He doesn't have this problem. Moses is, he has a mission. He understands something of where this is going, but this kind of chaos is just frightening.
We're going to speak a little later in this conversation about the big ideas that underlie the covenant and some of the specific laws and ordinances that follow. But upon receiving that the covenant from God, with God, we've just been speaking about how Jethro advises Moses,
yep,
about a certain way to establish justice within the Israelite settlement. And that, it seems to me, it's worth opening that up a little bit, because there's going to be an interesting contrast with the covenant that will follow. The principle that Jethro has in mind in establishing order in Israel is what?
Well, we need something slightly behind. Jethro arrives. He's heard these rumors that something good has happened with these Israelites. He hasn't seen Moses in years. He sees Moses sitting all day and night with crowds of people hovering over and above him, demanding that he resolve their disputes. And he says, this is not good. And what Jethro sees is Moses ruling one man as if he were a philosopher king. It's monarchy. Moses says he's sort of teaching them God's ways, but God's ways haven't yet been told. Moses is somehow divining what the rules are and making them up as he goes along. Jethro says, no, that's not good. And he says, what you really ought to do is delegate. You should get a series of judges and in rank order. You save the big cases for yourself, but there'll be at various levels of judges. And here's the principle. Find Anshei Chayil. Find nobles. Find and it's not clear what that would mean in these circumstances. Go find the people who are either people of good character and judges and nobility, or find the wealthy or prosperous people and appoint them judges. And Moses does that. And Jethro also tells him, and by the way, you should get some kind of divine support for these laws. There really should be some kind of order. When they actually come and settle at the foot of Mount Sinai, the people settle on the ground, but wasting no time, Moses is up the mountain. Presumably, I think, following Jethro's hint that he needs a little divine assistance. You'll remember a very long time ago, when Moses tried to break up the fight between these two brawling Israelites. One of them said to him, "Who made you a prince, ruler, and judge over us? Mind your own business." That man told Moses basically, and told everybody, what was needed. Somebody had to appoint Moses ruler and judge over them, and Moses is on his way to getting that kind of authority, but also with law, not only his authority and his imagination.
Okay, so the principle that Jethro introduces, or elaborates,
yep,
explains, is nevertheless still a hierarchical principle.
Correct.
Moses had first been the sole ruler of Israel,
right,
and Jethro helped him understand how a different kind of hierarchical structure could help. That must have been entirely natural in the ancient world of in which the politics of the Bible finds itself.
Yes. This is a kind of aristocracy. It's very hard to know with this motley collection of ex-slaves who the aristocrats are. I mean, maybe some people came out with more cattle than somebody else. No one has distinguished themselves in battle or in any other kind of way where you could discern leadership. But at least was Jethro's attempt to introduce what would have been a going principle. And we might as well put this in here now. When the Israelite law comes, scholars will compare it to, for example, the Code of Hammurabi, which in one of its striking features has three sets of laws: laws for the gentry, laws that affect the commons, and laws for slaves. And the law that will be given in Israel is given uniformly to each and every Israelite without distinction of rank.
That is, it seems to me, the most important political revolution.
Correct.
Introduced by this text.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, this, and we're a little ahead of ourselves, but this is a covenant, which we're going to look at in a minute, which is made in the second person singular with the universal many, and not with the few. God is not interested in the good life only for philosophers or princes or nobles or even prophets like Moses himself, but in providing a way that would elevate the possibility of a flourishing and decent and even godly life for common humanity.
Okay, so now let's enter into the drama of this initial covenant.
Good.
Tell us about how it comes about.
Okay, Moses, as I say, eagerly goes up the mountain, and the Lord God of Israel meets him and tells him, "You should say unto the children of Israel, to the house of Jacob, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I have brought me to you on eagle's wings. Now, if you will hearken to my commandments and keep my covenant, you will be to me a treasure among all the nations, for all the earth is mine. You will be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." And Moses goes down and tells the people, and the people with one voice say, "What he said, we will do." That's the opening. God proposes a covenant, which has to be consented to. The covenant is an astonishing covenant. It's based upon the evidence of what they have seen, what they have seen, what he did to the Egyptians, what they have seen of his providential bringing them to him at this mountain by nurturing them in the wilderness and so on. But having seen that, they now should trust in this new offer that he's making, which will consist in their hearing, hearkening, obeying these commandments and keeping this brit, this covenant. And then there'll be wonderful consequences for them.
Maybe the place to begin to unpack all of this is with that term, brit, covenant. It would stand to reason that this is much more than a law. That is not the right way to understand what this is. What is it?
That's a good question. The term itself means a bond that is established between two parties, very often unequal parties, who in the absence of this bond might have absolutely nothing to do with each other. They are not naturally akin. Unlike a contract, which is a purely transactional agreement in which I give you something and you give me something else, and if there's a breach of contract, you can in court sue and be indemnified for the loss. But when the contract is fulfilled, there's no further relation. This is, in fact, an enduring relationship based not simply on mutual advantage, but based upon a relationship of trust, attachment. It requires not just fulfillment of terms of a contract, but requires even more dedication, devotion. It's the difference between a marriage and a rental lease. This is an astonishing thing for this group of ex-slaves to be offered, that the Lord God who delivers them offers them the opportunity to be in a permanent relation with him. What it means, they don't yet know. But they're all ears.
And that the promise which is offered is that they are to be transformed into a nation of priests, into a holy people. What is that?
Well, look, I mean, you and I have enough difficulty trying to figure out what it means when we read it in the text. Imagine what these people on the ground might think about this. First of all, by the way, this is the first time that anybody has told them that they are going to be a people among the peoples of the earth. Up until now, they've been the bottom of the bottom in the hierarchy of Egypt, and what they know of themselves, they know only of oppression. But now they're told that the God who is the God of all the nations of the earth sees them as a people equal with the others, not only equal, but possibly in a superior relation, a treasure to the God who is the God of all the earth. What it means to say you will be a kingdom of priests, what they think of it, what we think of it, does it mean that each one is going to be in some kind of priestly relation to God as somehow doing, ministering to him in their daily life? Does it mean that they will be a nation that serves a priestly function to the rest of the world? Does it mean that they're eventually going to be a theocracy governed by priests? Don't know. A holy nation. And we want to track this holy nation as we go along because it's absolutely of the essence. A holy nation, the word kedusha means set apart. Set apart for what? Set apart how? Does it mean that they have a kind of special calling in the world? Does it mean that they are going to aspire to be in a special relation to God and embody in their daily life not just decency and justice, but something beyond that? It's an inspiring vision for the future for people who didn't know they had a future at all. And I can only imagine that in their ignorance of what these terms mean, it nevertheless looks grand, and it looks to them that they've been delivered not only negatively from evil, but they might just have a great role to play in the human story, as if I might editorialize, indeed they have.
Now, of course, the image of the priest that this people would have been familiar with would be the priests of Egypt. The priests of Egypt who are preoccupied with the manipulation of nature, with the administration of an empire, we'll have to just see if those meanings transfer over. The reason I want to linger on that is because the thing in their head would also inform the quickness with which they agree.
Right.
What do you make of this agreement?
The agreement, I think, is they consented, but they were not well informed. And in fact, there's even a kind of clue. What they say to Moses is, what he said we will do. They haven't heard anything. If you will hear my commandments and keep them, well, they haven't heard any of them. I mean, they've signed up without knowing really what they've signed up for. And Moses reports back the people have agreed, and God says, do this. And Moses says again, but they've agreed. And God understands this agreement isn't worth anything yet. A lot more has to be done. And the agreement has to be offered in the midst of a spectacle, because speech and reason is sufficient for Moses, but the people will need all kinds of additional things as they needed before, signs and wonders. And the pyrotechnics which follows is absolutely indispensable to bringing about the desired result.
And that would seem to suggest that just thinking, again, trying to think politically about how a leader looks at the people. If the larger political ambition and moral ambition of Exodus is to remove the slavish instincts inculcated generation after generation in this people, nevertheless, one can't just begin with the assumption that because one wants to achieve that purpose, it automatically has obtained.
Right.
One must understand the people who before you.
Right.
And God seems to be teaching us, the reader at least, something about that in the provision of yet more signs and wonders.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's going to be a very gradual process, and there will be one step forward and two step back. The murmurings that we heard before about the food and drink will arise again in other instances. Moses is getting some kind of instruction, too, as to what's sort of needed to bring this about. And we will see it over and over again. Moses doesn't understand the needs of the people and doesn't really admire them.
Finally, when we think about what the people themselves know of this God, they have seen his defeat of the most powerful empire they've known.
Correct.
They know him as a leader of war. They also know him as the provider of food.
Right.
It's now come for God to reveal more about what he expects.
Right.
Let's enter into perhaps with the thunder and lightning surrounding the mountain, what God says.
Well, God makes a speech famous in the tradition as the Ten Commandments. They are not obviously ten, and they're not said to be commandments. It says, and the Lord spoke all these words, and it's in the midst of thunder and lightning and ram's horns and so on. And then we get these words, and Jews and Christians, they both say 10, but they number them differently and account them differently. And general structure, we could say, is something like this. He begins by saying, in the kind of synoptic overview, and this is very, very important, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Jewish tradition will treat this in a way as the first commandment to believe in the one God, the Lord God of Israel. But as I read the text, this is really just the statement of the suzerain to his vassals, saying, here's who I am, and here's what I require of you. So he's identifying himself for them. The one speaking to you right now, here at this mountain, I'm the very one who brought you out of Egypt. And if you don't remember Egypt, out of the house of bondage. So the children of Israel are given at this moment a wonderful kind of either-or. This is a historical statement that conditions their entrance into this covenant. Mm-hmm. But there's a kind of philosophical statement implied in it too. Either you're going to be in relation to me, or the other alternative is the one you've just left. Either you're going to have a relationship with me, or bondage and degradation are the alternative. Listen up. After this initial statement, in which the children of Israel might be listening for how are we going to be in relation to him, he gives us three statements which are all in the negative about how not to be in relation to me. First of all, no other gods. Second of all, no graven images that you should worship. And third of all, you shouldn't be in relation to me by talking about me in vain, by using my name. No other gods, no images, no vain use of God's name. So they're sitting here after three of these pronouncements, and they're wondering, well, I mean, how are we supposed to be in relation to you? And fortunately, beginning with the so-called fourth commandment, we have some instruction. The fourth commandment is one of two positive commandments. They represent, I think, along with the injunction against idol worship, to which we should return more fully. But the two positive commandments, the one about Sabbath observance and honoring father and mother, are, I think, the unique Israelite contributions to that world, to our world. And it's worth going slowly through them.
Okay. Well, where should we begin? Should we return to idol worship?
I'd rather begin with these two.
Okay.
Because idol worship, that becomes a kind of dominant theme. I would rather begin here because the structure in the 10 words is negative, negative, negative. I want to know how to be relation to you.
Right.
Oh, here are some positive teachings. And it turns out those positive teachings are important not only as we've discerned it from the fact that they're positive, but they become of the absolute essence of what it means to aspire to be a holy people, which was one of the main purposes of this covenant as announced to them to begin with.
Okay.
So let's do those first.
Indeed. So when we heard a few moments ago in the establishment of this initial covenant, the promise that the people of Israel would be kadosh, set apart, we now come to another form of setting apart,
right?
A particular day.
Right.
So how are these connected and how does the Sabbath holy tell us about that?
Okay, the injunction is remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you may work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath day unto the Lord. And everybody in your household, you, your sons and your daughters, your maidservants, your manservants, the stranger who's in your gate, and even the animals are to rest on the seventh day. And a reason is given for this. Why? Because in 6 days God created the world, but on the seventh day God rested.
Wait a second. I believe that would have been the first time that these people would have been told that the very God who acts in history, who delivered them from Egypt, is the same God that created that is the author of creation.
Correct. No one in the story knows this until this moment, not even Moses. It's not been said to any human being. This is where what the reader of Genesis 1 gets on the first page the human beings in the world get only at this moment.
Okay. Another astounding disclosure.
It's an enormous, important disclosure. And what are they thinking when they hear this? They're supposed to reconfigure time. Other people have sacred animals, sacred personages, sacred places, sacred rituals. What the Israelites are told, and this is the first teaching about what holiness might mean for them, what is to be holy, made holy, is the time of their life. And against their life in Egypt, which was toil and sorrow 7 days a week, ceaseless, here the rhythm of life is going to be work, but work for the sake of leisure, work for the sake of rest. It's the antithesis of slavishness. It's an antithesis of thinking, well, look, you work for a living, but you have to live for some purpose, which is beyond just being alive. And here there's the beginning of a teaching that we will reorder your concept of your life, not according to the motions of some heavenly bodies, moon and so on, but on the rhythm of a seven-day week tied to the rhythm of God's own creative work and his own resting. You will sanctify time. You will remember it all week and point toward it as the telos of your time. And this is just stunning. Why are you supposed to do this? You're supposed to do it because I did it. These ex-slaves are being invited to imitate, not just to remember and recreate symbolically the creation, but to be like God in the way in which they live in the world. What an invitation.
I mean, I don't think that this idea, the significance of this idea can be emphasized enough. Right. I'm thinking, Dr. Cass, of how in English there are surnames that described the profession or the vocation of a person, so that that English-speaking nations are full of Smiths and tailors and such. That is understandable, because for most of human existence, the work that a person did was who they were.
Right.
And here is an invitation to be something other than the toil of your life.
Yep.
Astounding.
It really is astounding. And it is a way of, they don't know this yet, but in the first creation story, the human being, the first creation story demoted the standing of the heavenly bodies and pointed to the human being as the peak of creation. And the human being was said to be created B'Tselem Elohim, in God's image, in his likeness. That very fact meant that he had all kinds of powers that the other creatures didn't have, and it made man something of a problem. But there's also a promise in being the most godlike of the creatures. And here there is an invitation to live your life to fulfill the promise rather than the problematic character of that aspect of your very being.
Okay, and how should we think about the relationship of this one of the 10 sayings with the other positive 10 of the 10 sayings?
The second positive and unique saying, honor your father and mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord God is giving you. A couple of innovations just off the top. Honor your mother equally with your father is an Israelite innovation in the ancient world. All honor down the male line, patronyms, etc. Honor your father and mother, singled out, not kings, not warriors, not other kinds of luminaries, but singling out your very own parents as the sole obligatory object of honoring. It says honor. It doesn't say love. It doesn't say obey. It means to treat with a certain deference. In fact, the word honor means, is related to the word for weight, to treat as weighty these people. If you're imitating God in the previous sentence in honoring the, in remembering and keeping the Sabbath, here you're as far away from this universal cosmological source of the world in giving special honor to your very particular parochial and mortal parents. It's you owe them for your being, so that there is a creation echo in that. You owe them for their nurture and rearing. You owe them for their initiation, God willing, into a way of life that will remember the Sabbath and be more than just comfort, safety, and prosperity. This also has a... There are two other things that have to be said about the importance of honoring your father and mother. It's fitting. It's we owe it. Second, it's indispensable for the parental task of rearing. They have authority over you. And we have an old story, the story of Ham and Noah and his sons, and how Ham celebrates the unfathering of himself of Noah and rebellion in the very first household after that covenant. That problem has to be addressed, and it's addressed right here. If you want to have parents who can transmit a covenant, there has to be respect and reverence on the part of the children. But that's not sufficient. And the clue for its what's missing comes when a little later on in Leviticus, God says to the, Moses says to the people, "I am, be ye holy, for I am holy. Let every man fear, revere his mother and his father, and keep my Sabbaths. I am the Lord your God." Holiness in Israel, the two central ingredients of holiness turn out to be these two commandments, keeping the Sabbath, and there it's put fear, revere, and your mother first and your father second. So you're thinking about this. Your father and your mother. Reverence your father and mother. Fear, revere them. What problem, the antithesis of holiness, is this meant to address? My sense of this, and we could support it with evidence in the text, is that this is a problem to address the dangers of incest and patricide, the dangers that lurk in the uninstructed human household, which we have seen in Genesis in those uninstructed tales. If you can introduce something like reverence into the household, a certain distance, a certain looking up to parents, and therefore the parents somehow tacitly ordered to behave in order to deserve that reverence, the household will not degenerate into this kind of den of iniquity and a seedbed of tragedy that the household uninstructed very often is. You see that in Greek tragedy, which just lays it bare. So, and this business about so that days will be long on the land that the Lord God has given you is an echo of the sentences that occur elsewhere about how the land vomited out the Canaanite. For what? For these incestuous, wildly licentious sexual practices, including sex with animals. The household is a dangerous place. And if there's going to be a holy people, we have to order that household, not just from gratitude, not just for utility, but also to introduce an element of kedusha, of holiness, into a place which is otherwise a very dangerous and capable of being a degenerate place.
Okay. We're about to hear verse after verse of additional laws and ordinances. Why are these set apart, do you think?
Why are the ten?
Yes.
The ten set apart? The ten are... they're not called commandments. I think they are the defining principles of the new way of life. They're in a way like the preamble to the Constitution of the United States. they're not somehow meant for judges and so on, but they're sort of define attitudes. And after the words about honoring your father and mother, you get the so-called second table: no murder, no adultery, no theft, no bearing false witness, and then a very interesting one, which we don't probably have time to go into, about coveting, a teaching, very important teaching about the state of your desires, about how you stand toward your neighbor, and so on. These are sort of guiding principles for what it would mean not only to be not a slavish people, but what it would mean to be a self-governing people that had a telos, an aspiration for something even beyond decency and justice. And when one comes to the ordinances, one sees reflected in the ordinances this same, one sees a certain laying out of these principles in some detail, but one also sees a laying out of the overall trajectory from concern with crimes and torts to a concern with care for supererogatory things like caring for the strangers and the widows and the orphans, and ultimately in the direction towards sanctity and holiness.
Okay, so maybe you could just give us a tour through some of the outstanding ordinances that follow.
Look, the ordinances, I want to say a couple of general things about the ordinances. The ordinances are the place where we think we could see addressed all of those evils that lurk in the hearts of man that the reader has been introduced to. The ordinances we would expect would provide those things that Jethro suggested Moses should get provided, namely how to produce regulation that would govern the daily affairs of men, especially to rule out mutual wrongdoing in crimes and in torts. But we would expect that the ordinances would also deal with some of the unruly internal passions that enslave people: fear, despair, greed, pride, hubris. And finally, and this is a very important political thing, up until now we've seen Moses working by the seat of his pants and in an exalted position with the people. We didn't mention the people's reaction to the Ten Commandments, where they say, "Moses, you speak to us. Don't let God speak to us." And I don't think they heard a word of the Ten Commandments. Moses' status is now risen very high. And we have to now define the relations between the leader and the led so that it will not be so great a gap that the people will become slavish again in relation to Moses and he won't have grandiose views. So we need a kind of order that can take the place of charismatic leadership when the leader goes, okay? These ordinances do all of those things. And they do them in a pedagogical order, they're not just a legal code the way the scholars treat it. They're an educational mission for the people on the ground and for the people reading as to how you can accomplish those purposes from the lowest to the highest.
Okay. It would seem that the very fact, again, that they are addressed to each of the people equally,
right,
would be the beginning of that teaching.
Correct. Yeah, and it's very striking. It's very striking that the first of the ordinances is about slavery. And it says, if you have a Hebrew slave, he shall go free for nothing after 7 years. Not surprising that these ex-slaves who've known a world of enduring servitude, chattel slavery, in fact, should be the first word told to them as part of their new mission is, if you're going to get slaves, and we may have to talk about slave, servant, it's very hard to know how to translate the word, but he goes free without ransom after 7 years. Just like the seventh day is a different day, So 7 years of toil, indentured servitude, ends with liberation in the seventh year. Just as you got out of Egypt without a ransom paid, just the slave goes out free for nothing. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of building on their own experience to see what? To see that Israel is not to be a nation in which there are permanent slaves. There are not going to be permanent divisions between the free and the slave. And if somebody is forced to enter servitude as a way of paying off his debts because he's destitute, or as we'll learn later, if he's stolen something and has to make good by labor, the basic humanity of the, even of the slave, and the rest of the laws will fill this out, he might be your servant, but he's still a human being, and you, he is one of your community, even though he works for you and can't get out of this contract until the seventh year.
Mm-hmm.
That's a foundational teaching, antithetical to what is Egypt. Just the way the Sabbath is antithetical to the workaday life and toil, so the first teaching about communal relations is no permanent servitude. There are not natural slaves or even permanent conventional slaves here. The slave is entitled to his freedom after he works off his debt.
And from this initial teaching, located in the social arena, in thinking about how Israelites will relate to one another,
right,
and indeed to non-Israelites among them.
Right.
How do the ordinances then instruct us eventually to look up at something higher?
Well, the culmination of the ordinances follow, after this comes the capital offenses in defense of life and a couple of capital offenses to underline the importance of honoring father and mother. If we have time, we can go back to it. Then bodily injury, torts, protection of property, protection of animals, protection against harm done by animals, harm done to animals, and so on. Then there's a kind of transition in the middle with three striking non-casuistical things. You shall not suffer a sorceress to live. Anybody who lies with animals shall be killed. And you shall not sacrifice to any god other than to me. And those apodictic central principles turn the direction of these things beyond crimes and torts to the things that are the special teachings of Israel, beginning with, how do you treat the stranger? You've just been told, don't worship any other god. No sacrifice to any other god. Repeatedly, antipathy to all other ways, but not antipathy to the human being from the other way who happens to be in your midst. That person is a human being despite the fact that he belongs to other ways. If he's away from home living in your midst, he's vulnerable. You treat him under the law like one of your own. Then there's stuff about the orphans, the widows, and the poor, other vulnerable people. And then there's a kind of shift even further in the direction of a sabbatical for the land. And then sacred festivals, not just sacred time. But the whole motion of the last part, beyond justice, beyond civil peace and order, is for the sanctification of everyday life. It's really toward educating your desires to look beyond avoiding mutual wrongdoing, but to aspire to the kind of relation with God in your everyday life that is being compressed here in this founding moment.
And why should these things be included in the laws of Israel?
Because the law is not as it is for us, primarily a way of regulating misconduct and solving disputes. The law is fundamentally a teacher. The law is fundamentally the laying out of guidelines. Not guidelines for what it would mean to live not just decently and not just justly, but to live a life that's commensurate with what it means to be in God's image, to live a life that will be fulfilling. It's a tall order. I mean, these are very demanding things. And it's, you know, if everybody understood everything that was going to be demanded of them, consent might not be so readily forthcoming. And it's going to, as we will see later, what we didn't say, by the way, at the beginning was, we know what happens when a contract is broken. The question is, can a covenant be broken, or is a covenant in perpetuity? And Israel is going to enter into this covenant, and then there will come a time down the road where, in our series, where that challenge to that covenant will be in spades.
We'll be tested.
The ambition of this law to elevate the people to think of something higher naturally invites the question of just how it is that deep human desire to relate to the high can be satisfied in the context of Israel. As we think about the next conversation that we'll soon have, maybe you could just anticipate for us some of the questions that will govern the way that we'll think about the tabernacle.
Right. I guess there's at least a couple of ways that have occurred to me and that at different times of my life were sort of dominant. Moses has a relation with God on a almost as a friend to a friend, it will be said later. And for Moses, speech and reason are sufficient. For the human beings, for the rest of the human beings, not so much. They need tangible signs. They need wonders. They want to bring sacrifices. They want to receive blessings, and there needs to be something else. And they have certain uninstructed. They have certain wild ways of doing this. The background against which we're talking about this, I remind you, is Egypt in the background, the place of rational mastery of things through technology. Lying just over the horizon are the Canaanites. And the injunctions against idolatry over and over again, and particularly these things having to do with sexuality and sexual license, have the Canaanites, the Egyptians too, but primarily the Canaanites in mind. And there's a certain kind of abandon, a certain desire to merge with things. And that's the Dionysiac element, which is one of the theological dimensions of the human soul. The immediate antecedent of the law about the tabernacle, and maybe this would be a way to point toward it, is what happens after the ordinances are given. God tells Moses, come up here and bring the elders. But Moses, quite on his own, says he's got some unfinished business to do. And he brings this this covenant with all of its details down to the people, and he reads it to them. And then he decides to ratify it without being instructed to this. He ratifies it. He has 12 pillars erected. He sacrifices a bunch of cattle. He throws some of the blood on the pillars, and then he throws a lot of blood all over the place on the people, uninstructed. And, you know, the nice people say, well, this was the ancient way of ratifying a covenant, but I think Moses is saying, look, these people need something splendid. I'm going to give them something splendid. This is going to be serious stuff. Blood is flying everywhere. Okay. And then Moses and the elders go up the mountain as requested. And they have this vision of the Lord God walking on streets of sapphire. And they sit down, they have lunch, and they eat and drink in the presence, presumably, of this divine vision. And I think what you have here is a certain sign that the people have a certain wild element that's been stirred up here. And the elite has a certain aesthetic element by which they're going to be in touch with something higher. And what comes next is instruction for a place that will be both beautiful and pleasing for the aesthetic, side and will be a place where the blood can be strewn, but under measure and with regulation. And so in the first instance, you could say this is going to be a place where one can cabin the wild and unruly passions of the people and satisfy the longings of the elite. And maybe that's a place to start, but I think when we really dig in to the tabernacle, we're going to see that Cass's suspicion that this was just a concession to human weakness is just wrong.
Okay. That's where we'll start next time.
Thanks, John.